We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. This morning, we will return to the subject of health care reform. And we decided that what we'd like to try to do here over the fall is to do a number of programs examining the subject from a number of different perspectives. And the very first show in this kind of informal series we're doing was the very day after the House passed its version of health care reform. We had two guests on that day, Dr. Javette Orgain, president of the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians, and also Sarah Collins. She's an economist who works particularly on health insurance issues with the Commonwealth Fund. And if you'd like to hear that program, it's on our web archive. You can go back and you can listen to it. This morning, we have two guests with us, again, to try to talk about some of the same sorts of things. Joining us by telephone is Dr. James Milam. He is the president of the Illinois State Medical Society. He is a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist from Libertyville. He's been in private practice for 18 years in Vernon Hills. He's also on the active staff at Lake Forest Hospital and Advocate Condell Medical Center. Here in studio with me is David Hyman. He's a professor of law here at the University of Illinois, considered one of the country's top health law scholars. Among other things, he's interested in the regulation of health care financing and has written on issues including medical malpractice and managed care. As we talk, questions are welcome. Please, though, do keep it brief so we can get as many callers in as we can keep the program moving along. But, of course, callers are welcome to call in with their questions and comments. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. At any point here, you're welcome to call. Well, here in studio, Professor Hyman, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us by telephone, Dr. Milam, thank you.
Morning. Thank you.
Just as a way of starting, I know that the American Medical Association has endorsed the bill passed by the House, and that it is my understanding that your organization, the Illinois State Medical Society, has not, and you can correct me because I'm having a little tough time here getting up to speed on this, has not taken a formal position. Is that correct?
No. Let me try to help out here a little bit.
Yeah.
What happened was the AMA actually supported the bill. There's a slight political distinction between endorse and support, but the reason they supported the bill is because it did contain many of the items that were necessary from the doctor's point of view regarding the future of healthcare and access across the country, and as well as insurance reforms and so on and so forth. What the Illinois State Society did was we thought it was important enough to the patients here in Illinois that we did our own analysis of the bill, and essentially we agreed with most of the AMA's positions. And to the extent that when the AMA just met this past weekend, we in Illinois were part of that delegation, and the AMA came out with a statement as of November 11, and it's on their website called hsreform.org that says what the AMA believes health reform legislation needs to include and what the AMA is against. And we at ISMS have our own open letter that we published to our citizens last week in most newspapers around the state, and that's at ISMS.org. Mm-hmm. So we're actually in concert. We're working together, and to the extent that the AMA and Congress can, let me rephrase that the Congress and the White House can work out something that's real, meaningful, and fixes the system, that's what we want, because ultimately we all want to take care of patients and
okay.
We want to do it in the best way.
So you there are some things that have been proposed that you favor, some things that you don't. It seems overall, though, that you're not entirely happy In fact, I'm reading, I have it here in front of me. It says, however, we cannot, and that is underlined, we cannot support the direction of current proposals before Congress. So what is it that that Congress is talking about, has been proposed, that you're most that you most take issue with?
Well, the government-mandated treatment guidelines that interfere with doctors' clinical decision-making and the doctor-patient relationship. We are complete opposition to a single-payer health system. We also don't think that the way to expand coverage is based on the current Medicare or Medicaid funding systems. And certainly anything that is in terms of a public option subsidized by the government, those are just some of the starting places where we think that it's just not a good idea to build a foundation for the future based on those premises.
Just one quick question about the public option, because it seems that this all along has been a major stumbling block, and now that action has shifted to the Senate, it seems to be even more of an issue where we have people saying that, in fact, I think Senator Lieberman is probably high on that list, who says if there is a public option, he won't, in whatever is up for a final vote, he won't vote for it. The according to the Congressional Budget Office, if there was a public option, they say maybe about 8 million people would sign up. And I think that when that story broke, a lot of people were saying, well, this is what all the fuss has been about, 8 million people, that's like nothing. If the program would be like that and just that small, does that still concern you?
Well, I think to the extent that the short answer is yes, only because what we would be afraid of, and I, you know, think if it were nuanced towards a public option that was government subsidized, then ultimately you're leaning towards a bureaucratic single payer system, which we know is fraught with difficulties, and ultimately we believe would essentially lower. Have an undersupply of doctors eventually, certainly the lack of patient choice, and all those places that have had government-controlled health care have ended up with long waiting periods and rationing, which is the dirty word. But that's, you know, the government can print money, and as long as we have an insurance model where the insurance companies are forced to make a profit, you're never going to have an equal system. So that's, right now, Medicaid and Medicare are public options. Mm-hmm. And they're not working, and there's cost shifting that's going on, and to the extent that there are access issues, we just think that those would be exacerbated by any sort of federal government-run insurance program.
Yeah. Let me ask you one other question, and then I want to bring Professor Hyman into the conversation here. You used the term rationing, and I think that that is something that many people say they're concerned about if we the direction that we're going in, that there would be rationing. Other people would say something like this. They'd say, we have rationing now, and we're rationing based on people's ability to pay. We have some tens of millions of people in this country who can't afford insurance, don't have access to insurance, and that's a problem that we need to solve. So if we say that's one of the biggest problems is access for some people, then my question to you is, well, how do we solve that problem?
Very simply, I think to get rid of the restrictions on insurance companies being able to sell across state lines and to have those insurance market reforms to get rid of the cherry-picking and rationing, which you're exactly correct, does occur right now. With insurance companies being able to exclude people for pre-existing conditions and have lifetime limits, all of those items which are supposed to be gotten rid of with the new legislation. The other thing that is, we don't want patients tied to a paycheck. And so if you have increased portability, then you'll have increased access. And I think that's the whole point. If we can get a national pool of patients, then the insurance companies essentially are going to be spreading the risk all across the country. And we're hoping that patients will then, by having increased access, we'll be able to afford some of those services, and we as a country are going to have to decide how we're going to pay for that, because right now some of the most expensive care that's rendered is in the emergency room, and that's the least effective way, especially in regards to prevention and wellness. So under those circumstances, we expect and we would hope that with those insurance market reforms and also getting rid of some of the antitrust problems that doctors and hospitals have by not being able to share information, that would then improve the access, and then we wouldn't have to worry about who's covering it right now, because right now there still is significant cost shifting. And so ultimately everybody's going to have to give up a little bit. Insurance companies are going to make a little lower profit, but that way we get patients to be able to be taken care of by a larger pool of doctors who can afford to take care of them.
Okay, let me just reintroduce quickly our guests, the person you've been hearing speak for the last few minutes. This is Dr. James Milam. He is the president of the Illinois State Medical Society. He is an OBGYN from Libertyville. He's joining us by phone. And here in the studio with me is David Hyman. He's professor of law here at the University of Illinois and is thought to be one of the country's top health law scholars and has written about things like regulation of healthcare financing and also medical malpractice. Well, let me turn to David Hyman here in the studio and ask sort of an open-ended question, and I guess that's where I've been trying to start in some of these conversations is to ask, well, what do you think are the big problems with healthcare and how it is that we should address them?
So people who write in this area typically say there are three big issues in healthcare. There's the cost of healthcare, the quality of healthcare, and the degree of access that people have to healthcare. On the cost, if you take a look at both the budgetary projections for Medicare and Medicaid, and also at the sort of share of people's paycheck that's going to pay for health insurance, you discover that costs are increasing in healthcare very rapidly, well ahead of inflation, have been doing so since basically the Johnson administration, 1964 sort of territory. And people across administrations and across Congresses have tried all sorts of different things and haven't really had a lot of success in finding a magic bullet. And, you know, we can talk later about why that is and some of the strategies. But basically, ever-increasing costs of healthcare price people out of the market, result in a higher share of the federal budget going for healthcare, crowding out of other things that we might want to spend money on, like education and national parks and national defense. So that's the first issue. The second issue is the quality of American healthcare. There's, I think, pretty consistent evidence that it's not as good as it ought to be, that where you live profoundly affects the care that you receive, and that in a variety of instances, we're not delivering optimal care to people, irrespective of their ability to pay for it. And then when you add in the problems of the uninsured, which Dr. Milam had referred to, you sort of make things worse because, as he correctly says, they receive care in different settings, disproportionately emergency rooms and public clinics. They don't tend to have a regular source of health care, and they tend to receive care when they're in a crisis rather than before that crisis hits. And then the last issue is access. Obviously, all three of these are linked to one another. But access, we have problems for access to health care. Some of that is geographic. If you live in certain parts of the country, it's very hard to find specialists. So there are stories about women having to travel long distances to find someone to deliver their children. Rural areas in particular, there have long been access problems. It's also important to note that when we talk about access, we mean access to health care. Health insurance is an important factor in getting access to health care, but just because you have insurance doesn't mean you can find someone to take care of you. Mm-hmm. So this has long been a problem in state Medicaid programs. They don't pay enough relative to other sources of care, and so it can be very difficult to find a physician whose practice is open to receive Medicaid patients. Less of an issue for Medicare.
Yeah. Well, let me just pick, and I promise I got callers, we'll get to them. Let me just pick one of those things and talk about access. And if we just narrow that down and say we're talking about access, not the access problem not being that there's no doctor in your neighborhood, you know, not that there's no doctor that you can go to, but that you would say that my employer is not providing anything, or maybe my employer provide something, and I've got to have big out-of-pocket cost. For those people who simply say, look, for me, the issue of access is affordability. I can't afford it. What do you think we do about that?
David, the answer to all of the above is yes. as was just pointed out, rural America has about half as many doctors per capita as urban areas. And I was just in Macomb last week. There's one ophthalmologist in town. It takes 6 weeks to get a cataract performed. She can't find anybody who will come work there. I talked to a primary care group who had to give up new Medicare patients because they can't afford to keep the office open because the reimbursement is so low. So it's a combination of all of the above. We spent $2.4 trillion on health care last year, and if we don't do anything, in 10 years it's going to be $4.4 trillion. So to the extent that we are eating up our country's budget in that sense. It's absolutely correct. Dr. Hyman, Professor, got it exactly correct as far as that goes, and something has to be done. And he correctly pointed out that we're using greater technology. People are living longer. We're having to figure out how we're going to take care of our older patients, and we baby boomers are part of the problem because we're increasing demographic, and we don't have enough folks who are paying into the system to be able to support the economic model as it exists right now.
Well, let me ask David Hyman here in the studio. What's particularly for this access issue when it comes down to affordability? And as the doctor says, you know, there are a number of different. You can look at this access question in different ways, but if we're really, if our bottom line is people saying I just can't afford it, what can be done about that?
So let me actually clarify one thing that your earlier question raised, right? You said my employer doesn't pay anything towards it or pays very little. You're right to observe that most insured Americans get their coverage through their place of employment. But it's a common mistake to think that the employer is actually paying for anything. That with the amounts that the employer is contributing is basically foregone salary. Okay. Mm-hmm. If we passed a law tomorrow that said employers can't provide health insurance to their employees, the market rate for your paycheck would go up to reflect the fact that instead of getting a salary plus health insurance, you were suddenly only getting a salary. So the rhetoric of sort of shared burdens of imposing a burden on employers really misunderstands the basic economics here. It's important to note that all workers are paying for their health insurance either by foregone salary or by purchasing it. But leaving all that aside, then the question is, okay, what if I can't afford to get it? And the answer is either we're willing to subsidize people to receive that care or we're not. And if we're willing to subsidize them by taxing ourselves and allocating money to do it, well, then you can get it. And if we're not, and historically, we actually have been willing to do it for certain populations. That's why we have Medicare and Medicaid. But we haven't been willing to do it as a collective, unlike many other countries. And so that's why we have a problem of the uninsured, which, just to sort of close the loop, is not the same thing as not receiving health care. Okay. If you look at the amounts of care received by the uninsured, they get about 60% of the dollar value that the insured get. They get it in a different setting. They get it later. It's not nearly as pleasant, to say the least. But being without insurance is not the same thing as being without health care completely.
And real quick here, I want to go back to Dr. Milam. What is your problem with the idea of a government subsidy for people who would genuinely say, I can't afford care?
Well, actually, there is no problem with that. And in fact, part of what we believe would be helpful would be to have either tax credits or some sort of subsidy for those people who cannot afford their own care. And we certainly do that right now with property taxes, keeping our emergency rooms open. And there's just absolutely no question that we believe that at some level everyone should be able to take care of it. One of the things that is frustrating right now is a patient may be tied to their health coverage through their employer. And so to the extent actually what Professor Hyman just said, as far as it being an offset for wages or part of that whole package, it's been that way since World War II. The problem is for myself or some other groups who are employers who are paying an exorbitant or too much out of their pocket in terms of overhead, the salaries, and then again they're passing along. Sometimes they can, if they make a product, they can pass it along, but sometimes you can't pass it along. So the question we have to decide as a country is how much are we willing to pay to how much of our GDP, if you will, are we going to pay for health care? Right now it's 17 or 18% or whatever, and it's going to increase. And how much do we want to pay in income tax? I mean, some of those European countries have cradle-to-grave coverage, but at 70% income tax rates. And so that's part of the conversation that we have to have as a nation is how are we going to take care of those less fortunate folks. But from our point of view, absolutely, there should be some basic level of what we call quality, affordable health care for all Americans.
But what you're saying is that what you would favor a system that would in essence, give the money to the individual and not give the money to the provider?
That's to a certain extent correct, to the extent that We also certainly believe in the ability to privately contract, and right now you can't do that in this country. So there should be some mechanism, and we would like to have more people have skin in the game, so to speak, that if people actually knew how much their health care costs, they might be better utilizers of their care. That's part of the notion of health savings accounts. So it's really almost a philosophical question. Who can be better in control of an individual's money, the individual or government telling them how they can spend it and how much will be spent? And, yeah. And that's the whole government rationing scare.
Okay. And I think you want to
just briefly, Dr. Milam is certainly correct that we've historically subsidized providers that provide care to the uninsured. So tax exemptions for nonprofit hospitals and what are called disproportionate share payments to hospitals are ways of trying to pay providers more for providing care to the uninsured. Massachusetts sort of flipped that model on its head and decided to subsidize individuals to receive health insurance. And they've had a fair degree of success in lowering the rate of the uninsured. The difficulty is the subsidies get very expensive very quickly because health care and health insurance are expensive. And so, you know, if the cost of the average policy is $12,500, the question you need to ask is how much income do you have to make to be forced to buy it on your own? And then you've got a problem with phasing out those subsidies. They result in what tax lawyers call high marginal tax rates, where it's very expensive to make a little more because you suddenly lose the subsidy.
I agree with everything he just said. He did it from an economics perspective, and that's exactly accurate.
All right. Well, we have several callers here, and let's start talking with folks. We'll start in with somebody in Champaign and our line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Yeah, this that we've been hearing from these two gentlemen is the same old song and dance in favor of the status quo that the AMA has been putting forth since the existence of the AMA. They've lobbied and created the system we have now, the broken, miserable system that allows 45,000 people, according to a Harvard study quoted yesterday in the New York Times, to die from a lack of medical care. This is absurd, and these gentlemen can go on and on. We've heard it all before, and it's all been refuted by massive studies, and the fact that 61% of the people in the United States want some more form of Medicare for everyone, access for everyone. And the idea that we can do this and provide wonderful profits to the insurance companies and have all these doctors earning twice as much as they ought to, perhaps, when they have twice as many doctors and pay half as much. Anyway, that's all I thought I'd throw in. Thank you.
All right. Well, Dr. Milam, you can respond to that.
Well, the system was put in by President Johnson way back when, and to the extent that when Medicare first started, the life expectancy was much lower, much shorter than it is right now. So we are products of our own success, and as I alluded to earlier, we baby boomers are part of the issue because, you know, there's 5 million of us, there's 71 million total, and we're turning 65 every year, and we don't have enough people to economically sustain it. There's no question that everyone around understands that there is a problem, and we have a system that cannot be sustained as it is. And so I would respectfully disagree that we're trying to maintain the status quo. That's quite inaccurate because we have to fix something. the question is, how do we get there? And I think there is a not uniform agreement around the country about how to get there, and certainly his point about people being happy with Medicare is exactly correct. If you are receiving your Medicare, but last year 25% of the people who lived in New York and Texas couldn't find a primary doctor to take their Medicare insurance, and those practices who are closed to new Medicare patients are the ones who are starting to show the real access issue that we're going to have. It will eventually reach critical mass because Medicare requires cost shifting to the private insurance companies because Medicare is woefully underfunded, and it's just not going to change in the near future.
You want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think there's broad agreement. There are a whole bunch of problems with the American healthcare system. I spend a lot of my time writing about those problems. There's much less agreement as to what the reforms ought to look like to address that. And some of that has to do with philosophical issues. Some of it has to do with economic issues. Some of it has to do with genuine differences of opinion as to what the right strategy actually is, even if you control for everything else. So that's the first point. I agree with Dr. Milam that the system is unsustainable in its current form, but it doesn't follow what we ought to do. And with regard to the observation that there's, you know, broad public support for fill in the blank, I looked at the polling data, and it's very clear there's broad public support for almost any reform that you can come up with, right up until you attach a price tag to it. And when you attach a price tag to any reform, public support for it drops precipitously. So you need to be careful in saying people want X if they're not actually willing to pay for X, whatever X is, whether it's a one-payer system, a Medicare for all system, a medical savings accounts for all system, or some form of intermediate solution.
All right, let's go to Urbana for another caller here. Line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was deeply involved in the drive for health care reform 20 years ago in the late 80s until the Clinton presidency. I have watched the Illinois Medical Society and the AMA over this long period of time, and I'm just going to, you know, directly take on your good faith and credibility in what you're saying. You folks have blocked health care reform in every possible manner. You're saying exactly the same things as you were saying 20 years ago. Market forces, market solutions. We had a Republican president, a Republican Senate, and a Republican Congress for 6 years, and all of these highly touted market solutions, not a one of them was enacted. Nothing was done. But as soon as someone comes to propose some sort of comprehensive approach, the docs, Big Pharma, and the insurance companies all triangulate to explain why it is that we have got such a huge problem. The truth of the matter is the only thing outstanding about our healthcare system is the outrageous expense. We don't have better outcomes than our industrial competitors. I'm a fan of single payer because I lived in Canada for a number of years, but if you don't want that, we could simply adopt the German system, which is not single payer. We could adopt the French system, which is not single payer. We could adopt any of the European countries. Just go take their legislation and apply it, and we would be better off. But the result would be that doctors would not be paid quite as handsomely as they are now. The pharmaceutical companies would be reined in, and the proliferation of insurance companies that are skimming off, you know, 20% to 30% of the expenditures for their overhead would disappear. But you simply can't defend what we're doing now. And all of your everyone can nitpick around the edges of the various proposals, but the docs are trying to protect their turf and their income. Pharma's trying to protect their turf and their income, the insurance companies, and we can't do it. It's going to drive us into industrial ruin. All of our industrial competitors are doing it for 30% less money with better outcomes. And the last comment you made about our success, increasing longevity is killing us, all of our European competitors have got longer life expectancy than we do, and they can afford it. So that's just bogus, and the Illinois Medical Society should be ashamed of itself.
Well, Dr. Hyman, I expect we could probably go on all morning and we would hear from a lot of people who would echo the comments of the last two callers. And I guess, I would say, well, how do you respond?
Dr. Milam, you mean?
I'm sorry.
Okay,
Dr.
no, that's Milam, okay. Yeah. Well, the first thing that I would say is Frontline, night before last on Tuesday, had a great program, an hour program called Sick Around the World. And they went through various countries, and ultimately the last one they mentioned was Taiwan, which just about a number of years, small number of years ago, decided to look at all of the programs around the world and kind of do an a la carte and took what they thought were the best practices. So they have one ID card for everybody. They have a health information system that everybody is connected to, and you go and pay a small amount, and the government subsidizes the rest of it. But they also will not let you utilize too much, and if you do, then you get a little call from the government saying you are going to the doctor too many times in a certain amount of years. I, again, would respectfully disagree that there is some sort of triangulation. I mean, doctors take care of patients, and our goal is to make sure that patients get taken care of. We as a society have chosen to not change the insurance system as it is right now. It's for profit, and that, you know, is up to the voters to change if that's what they want to do. But as far as pharma is concerned, you know, again, we have nothing to do with pharma. What we are trying to do is make sure that we have real, access to all patients, and for that is to say, access for all patients to doctors. And, you know, we do have to do a better job of prevention and wellness, and we've got to have some personal responsibility. Basically, doctors take care of patients' bad choices. You know, that's kind of what we do. We have a lot of civil liberties here in America, including the right to die and refuse life-saving treatment. And we also have a higher homicide rate and suicide rate than some of the other industrialized countries. We also struggle with the ends of life, whether it's premature babies or people at the end of life. We spend a lot of money at end of life rather than hospice, which is some of the other enlightened countries do. And we spend a lot of money trying to resuscitate the smaller babies that is not that resuscitation doesn't happen in other countries. So I would respectfully disagree that's the same song and dance, because we as docs have tried to, and myself specifically, have tried to fix the system so that I can continue to take care of the patients that I went to school to learn how to do.
Well, just real quick here, and we're significantly past our midpoint, and I apologize to the caller because I have my lines are full and I want to get on some others. But
yes.
And forgive me if I'm putting words in your mouth, but it sounds as if what you're saying, the way that you're explaining this fact that we spend much more than other industrialized countries do, and we're not healthier, it sounds to me like you're blaming the patients, that it has to do with patient expectation and it has to do with patients' lifestyle and the kind of problems that they have when they come to the doctor.
So some of that is true. The vast majority of our healthcare dollars are spent on technology and also on the drugs, and to the extent that we have you know, we've gotten rid of almost all the bad things that used to kill people in the old days, be it heart attacks or diabetes. The one biggest one, end-stage renal disease, is completely preventable. Hypertension is all, and certainly lung cancer, almost completely preventable. That's where the big dollars are spent, and so to that extent, we think that we could lower health care costs if folks were to take better care of themselves. But that being said, we still have more research and development in pharma, and we have more technology, and we do more things with more instruments and devices than some of the other countries do, and we do it more quickly. There isn't the waiting lines that there is in some of the other countries. By the way, most of those other countries that have government insurance allow rich people to opt out if they want to. So there's a secondary market that's a cash market as well. But I will tell you that there is no collusion. There is no attempt to maintain the status quo. And I think to the extent that we've been trying to fight for the right of patients to continue to be able to see a doctor and have freedom of choice, freedom of doctors, and for the doctors to be able to continue to take care of patients, for some reason that message has been lost, because that's really what we're out there trying to do.
We are moving into our last 15 minutes of this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. James Milam. He's joining us by phone. He's president of the Illinois State Medical Society. He is a board-certified OBGYN from Libertyville. He's been in private practice in Vernon Hills for 18 years. Here in the studio with me is David Hyman. He's professor of law here at University of Illinois. He's a health law scholar. He's written about the regulation of healthcare financing, also medical malpractice and managed care. And we're talking about healthcare reform questions. Welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We'll go to Piatone, line number 4. Hello.
Oh, this whole thing's got my blood boiling. Good morning, guys. You know, I'm a small contractor, and I've employed a bunch of people in the past. I've had to lay them off because of high cost of insurance, because you know, the law requires me, if I have X amount of employees, I have to have insurance. Well, here's the problem I see, and it seems like nobody seems to want to go this route. Why not go after the insurance companies for fraudulent expenses? Because we all know they do this. They charge through the nose. I've had, I had an accident here a couple months back, and I got no less than 5 contractors sending me bills. I broke my nose one time, and it 5 grand later from the ER, and same thing. Drugs, another one. It seems to be the big fly in the ointment for senior citizens. These drug companies are putting stuff on the market before they're really technically ready, but on top of that, I mean, get the same drugs in Canada for half the price. I mean, to me, if wife, now, I'm not saying I'm an advocate with for the healthcare system revamping the whole thing from the government, because we know that they can't do anything, right? I'm very deathly scared of what's going on out there. It's going to sink what I already have and give it to somebody else. Why not go after these people who don't have it? If they want healthcare system, let them deal with it, you know, take care of their situation, and then at the same time go after the red tape and the fraudulency in the healthcare system.
Okay, let me jump in. You're right there, because that gives us at least one thing we can grab onto and talk about. And let me ask David Hyman, to what extent do you think that either administrative costs, red tape, misfeasance, malfeasance, whatever, on the part of insurance companies is contributing at all to the problem?
So you can the caller's actually raised a couple of distinct issues, right? One is healthcare fraud, which we actually have a reasonably significant healthcare fraud problem, particularly in the Medicare program, which, because it has such low administrative costs, has a serious fraud problem. It doesn't try and make sure that the bills are proper beforehand. As long as they satisfy the form requirements, they just go ahead and pay it. And then if they conclude later that there's a problem, they try and get the money back. The people in the field call it, quote, pay and chase. And 60 Minutes a couple of weeks ago had a big program about this, the serious fraud problems in South Florida, where very high Medicare spending. In fact, they got somebody who said, you know, people used to do cocaine smuggling, but they figured Medicare fraud is more lucrative and safer because your chances of getting arrested are lower and nobody's shooting at you. So, you know, that's a bit of a problem. That's a problem that involves all sorts of people in the system, right? It involves some doctors. It involves home health care providers. It involves sometimes unwitting patients. But we do have a fraud problem. It's a separate question whether our administrative overhead and red tape is higher than it ought to be. It's high in part because we've got lots of insurance companies and lots of doctors. And part of the thing that people have been trying to do over the past several decades is figure out ways of streamlining the system. Using more electronic billing and electronic records is going to be a part of that. That, I think, is a something we ought to be doing, but it's not going to be the sort of thing that'll change the rate of spending on healthcare inflation, which is the thing that's in the long run going to really make it hard to sustain anything like what we've currently got.
Right. We are happy that there's going to be some streamlining of claims processing and again, some of those insurance reforms that are going to go across state lines. We also have problems with antitrust right now. Doctors and hospitals can't talk to each other. We're underinvested in health information technology. And we haven't even talked, by the way, about the future of a workforce shortage that's happening right now. 39% of all Illinois practicing doctors are over the age of 50. 50% of medical students are women, and my specialty of OB at 75%. There's going to be a huge workforce shortage in the next 10 to 15 years. The College of Physicians believes that somewhere between 25 and 50,000 fewer primary care doctors in this country needs. And if it's bad in the rural areas right now, it's going to be even worse. And so we're at the beginning of a real problem that if something isn't done soon, we have students who are coming out in incredible debt, $160,000 average from a state school as of 2006. They're not interested in going into primary care. They're just not being able to pay off their student loans, and it's a whole big mess that is coming upon us very soon.
Well, let's go on again to another caller in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi, I'll be short. I'll associate myself with the remarks of the angry but civil people earlier that were attacking the AMA. I would like to point out that polls of doctors show that doctors generally support some kind of single-payer plan. They're tired of dealing with the insurance companies, but I'm sure that's not all of the reason. I'd Quentin Young, who listens to the show and maybe one of the callers that called in, is one of the founders of Physicians. I think he would be a great guest, and it's timely despite the fact that there wasn't any allowance for a vote on single payer, which was promised, and there was also provision to vote for the Simon Amendment, which is what I call it, which is the single state single payer option, to so that states could try it themselves. And there are about 17 states that have a movement to have a single payer at the state level, Illinois being one of them. So, but Massachusetts has pointed at, and it's a very similar sort of plan, but what I've been hearing from people that are watching Massachusetts closely is that what's happening now is the imperative to subsidize people buying insurance from the healthcare insurance scoundrels is actually looting a large portion of the rest of the social safety net in Massachusetts, including public health workers. It's horrific. So I'll just hang up and listen to the response. Thank you.
All right. Let's get David Hyman. What do you think?
Yeah, let me agree with the caller that I think state-based strategies have a lot of promise here, right? It does not appear that a single payer can pass the United States Congress, even if it had gotten a vote. It clearly the votes aren't there in the Senate to defeat a filibuster, and there's probably not a majority. I would note that, you know, 1 in 7 Democrats voted against the bill that did pass, which admittedly was not a single payer, but that shows even within the Democratic Party, which would be the natural home of enthusiasm for single payer, there's some division of authority or views as to what to do. The only candidate in the 2008 presidential election that came out in favor of single payer was Dennis Kucinich, and he wasn't in there for very long. I think state-based solutions have more promise regardless of what strategy you want to use. And I think it's useful because we can learn from it, right? Either the people who oppose single payer will turn out to be right and it will tank their healthcare system and their economy, or the people who are in favor of it are right and it'll be a wonderful solution to all of the healthcare problems. The way to find that out is to actually give it a run at a state level rather than trying to impose it at a federal level and deal with all of the consequences of that. The caller is also right that spending on health care crowds out other spending, and that was a point I made right at the outset. So you shouldn't be at all surprised that if you're going to spend more money on health care, you've got less money for everything else, whatever that everything else is, whether it's public health or public housing, national defense, national parks. You can just sort of keep going on down the list. Mm-hmm. There's a former undersecretary of the Treasury who had this nice quip that I think summarizes it. He said, think of the federal government as an insurance company with a small sideline in national defense and Homeland Security. I mean, that's the sort of nature of the federal budget if you take a look at it. Most of our money goes for, in one form or another, healthcare or payments on the national debt. Mm. And everything else is a much smaller percentage of the total.
Let me ask Dr. Milam, what would you think of the idea of a single-payer system in the state of Illinois, just a state system that would cover people in the state of Illinois?
Well, it's all about the funding, and that's part of the problem we have right now. Medicaid in Illinois is almost broke. Medicare is not paying enough to keep those doctors' offices open. So as it was just pointed out, we as a society have not decided how much we want to spend on health care. So far it's going wherever it goes, and it's going to have to be reined in because eventually it will consume us as it did with Bethlehem Steel and General Motors. It's just economically unsustainable. But I think to the extent that it goes back to an issue of resource utilization, in other words, people who are removed from their health care tend to spend more or more users in a greater percent than people who have an understanding about how much things cost. If people knew how much it cost, then the theory is that maybe they would be a little bit more frugal.
Next caller here. We only have about 5 minutes left. Next caller is in Champaign in line 3. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I wanted to say that Sick Around the World Frontline, that actually the last country was not Taiwan, it was Switzerland, which is the epitome of capitalism, the most conservative country in Europe. And they were able to reform. Their economic system is probably the most like ours. And I believe even in Switzerland, they're taxed at a higher rate than we are, as all the rest of the Europeans are. And I lived in Germany from 71 to 77. I had an acute scoliosis episode in 1969 and didn't get any really any care here in the U.S. that really did anything about it. As soon as I moved there, I started to get care. And while they may not be at the peak of technology as the U.S. is, a lot more trickles down to the common person. And I got just a whole raft of therapies, and I got 4 weeks at a spa, intensive spa cure. And because of that, I'm walking relatively upright these days. I also had a child there in 1977, no copays during pregnancy, 10 days in the hospital for a vaginal birth, 6 weeks pregnancy leave, 8 weeks birth leave at full pay. Then I returned to the U.S. and had another baby 2 years later on a graduate student's, my husband was a graduate student, insurance, and that was a total nightmare. So we really need to do something here.
All right. I appreciate your comment.
I thank the caller for jogging my memory. Switzerland was the last country with a population of 8 million, but a high income tax, which so far we in this country haven't been willing to pay for.
All right. Anything you, David, you want to
add? I just add, you know, the population of Illinois is 12 million. The population of the United States is 300 million. We're a much more diverse country, much more diverse settings. That complicates nationwide adoption of any given system, whatever it happens to be, which is why I think state-based systems have more promise. And I would also point out that the Commonwealth Fund, which is a big booster of health reform, has actually done surveys across countries trying to get a sense of whether people like their healthcare system. And the striking thing to me was across a very broad array of systems, there's a lot of unhappiness. That is to say, different countries pay different amounts for healthcare and get different results if you look at their populations. But there's a high degree of unhappiness no matter what your system is. It's really a striking finding.
All right.
One of the last comments I'd like to make right now, Illinois is 16.9, 17% primary care shortage areas, which is among the highest of all the states. And so we have a huge underserved population, and it's unfortunate. Even the amount of the entire population of Massachusetts, 30-something million, is equal to the amount of uninsured in California. So it's we have a national problem that's going to require some national thinking. And as was pointed out earlier, we have a great diversity of opinion, and we're just not all sure how to get there, as it were.
Okay, and let's go to line number two in Champaign. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Good morning.
Yes.
Good morning. Well, I do believe that I started listening a little bit too late, but if there is no that much of a spending for wars and defense, we will have plenty of money for everything else. And right now we do have government-run programs like Medicare and Medicaid, and they're almost broke. So since when the government intervene or start getting control on businesses, we'll have a more prosperous entity. America is great because of the competition, the free enterprises, the free market, not when the government doesn't produce anything. Well, where are they going to get the money to fund all those programs? And, of course, cut options for people, cut their services, and et cetera, et cetera. So there is and we are just the money they are borrowing now, American taxpayers are having $500 million per day and an interest to pay. So there is so much, and, of course, they have to be, those things have to be leave to the states. Right now the government is employing 23 million people. That's communism.
Yeah. Let me get back here to the overall question the caller seems to be raising, essentially saying, you know, we've only got so much money to spend. And if we weren't spending so much money on the defense sector, well, then we could do other things with that money. Let me ask David Hyman. I mean, that maybe this is just like a nice subject for debate, but is if we were able to reallocate money from any place else and put it into what we're spending on healthcare, would that make a big difference?
So I've just pulled up the pie chart of the federal budget to try and answer it. And normally I would not rely on Wikipedia without checking somewhere else, but it was the first web page I could find. And it says total spending on the Department of Defense is $515 billion. This is a 2009 federal budget. That's a lot of money. But we spend $640 billion on Social Security, $400 billion on Medicare, $225 billion on Medicaid and SCHIP, $260 billion on national debt. You know, the total mandatory spending is almost $2 trillion. The discretionary spending is about $1.2 trillion. I think, you know, obviously, if you spend more money on something, you've got less money to spend on something else. Mm-hmm. I said that at the outset. But, you know, the rate of inflation in healthcare and the trajectory of our mandatory spending is such that we got to cut that back on mandatory spending, no matter how much we find from somewhere else.
We're at the point we're going to have to stop, and my apologies, we have some callers we can't take. We're certainly interested in continuing to talk about these issues. We're up for any suggestions from people listening on future topics and guests, and we do indeed want to get different perspectives on this issue and give you a chance to say what you think and ask questions. We're just going to have to leave it there with the promise that some of these things we'll try to get back to, including I think one thing we need to be talking about is how it is we educate a medical workforce and even have enough doctors to meet that need. But for now, I think we have to leave it at that with our thanks to our guests. Joining us by phone, Dr. James Milam. He is a board-certified OBGYN. He is president of the Illinois State Medical Society. Dr. Milam, thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity. Thanks for having me.
And here in the studio with us, David Hyman. He's professor of law here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Thank you.
Thanks for including me.
WILO programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe offers specialty coffees, breakfast featuring a choice of cold and hot breakfast items from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m., to-go sandwiches and salads for lunch. Bevere Cafe is student-operated in Bevere Hall at the corner of Gregory and Goodwin in Urbana. We are WILL. WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. We will pause at this point for an update on the markets and news, then we'll be back. Stay tuned.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
It's 10:59, and with this market update, I'm Tom Rogers. The wheat market remains up today, and so do the beans, although the increases have backed off the open. And corn has actually improved a little bit after spending much of the day down. December wheat in Kansas City right now is at 541 a bushel, up 6. The March at 557 and a quarter, up 7. December wheat in Chicago is currently trading up 6 cents at 537 and 3 quarters. The March up 6 and a quarter at 558 and a half. December corn right now is down a quarter penny at 390 and a quarter. The March contract also down a quarter at 405 and a half. May at 414, down 1 and a half. July corn 423 and 3 quarters, unchanged. Energies right now, the crude oil is trading down 51 cents a barrel at $76.43. RBOB gasoline at $1.92.6. That's down 1 4 cents. To the bean complex now, November soybeans at $9.90 a bushel, up 7 3/4 cents. The January $9.93 3/4, up 3 3/4. March at $9.99 5, up 3 3/4. May at $10.02, up 3 1/4. And July at $10.06, up 2 1/4. December bean meal at $304.90, up $4.10. Soybean oil for December at $38.26, down 11.